There's sometimes 50 of them in their sheds up hobbitin' wee. But they go out from there roving round, thieving or gathering, as they call it. Still, they're seldom less than a score round the boss, as they names him. He's at Bag End, or was. But he don't go outside the grounds now. No one's seen him at all, in fact, for a week or two. But the men don't let no one go near.
Hobbiton's not their only place, is it? Said Pippin.
No, more's the pity, said Cotton. There's a good few down south in Longbottom and by Sarn Ford, I hear, and some more lurking in the woody end, and they've sheds at Weymeat. And then there's the lockholes, as they call 'em, the old storage tunnels at Mickle Delving that they've made into prisons for those as stand up to them. Still, I reckon there's not above 300 of them in the shire all told, and maybe less. We can master them if we stick together.
Have they got any weapons? Asked Mary.
Whips, knives and clubs, enough for their dirty work. That's all they've showed so far, said Cotton. But I dare say they've got other gear if it comes to fighting. Some have bows, anyway. They've shot one or two of our folk.
There you are, Frodo, said Mary. I knew we should have to fight.
Well, they started the killing.
Not exactly, said Cotton. Leastways, not the shooting. Took started that. You see, your dad, Mr. Peregrine, he's never had no truck with his Lotho, not from the beginning. Said that if anyone was going to play the chief at this time of day, it would be the right thane of the shire and no upstart. And when Lotho sent his men, they got no change out of him. Tooks are lucky. They've got those deep holes in the green hills, the great smiles and all, and the ruffians can't come at 'em. And they won't let the ruffians come on their land. If they do, Tooks hunt 'em. Took shot three for prowling and robbing. After that, the ruffians turn nastier, and they keep a pretty close watch on Took land. No one gets in nor out of it now.
Good for the Tooks, cried Pippin. But someone's going to get it again now. I'm off to the Smiles. Anyone coming with me to Tuckborough?
Pippin rode off with a half a dozen lads on ponies.
See you soon, he cried. It's only 14 miles or so over the fields. I'll bring you back an army of Tooks in the morning.
Merry blew a horn call after them as they rode off into the gathering night. The people cheered.
All the same, said Frodo to all those who stood near, I wish for no killing, not even of the ruffians, unless it must be done, to prevent them from hurting hobbits.
All right, said Merry. But we shall be having a visit from the Hobbiton gang any time now, I think. They won't come just to talk things over. We'll try to deal with them neatly, but we must be prepared for the worst. Now, I've got a plan.
Very good, said Frodo. You make the arrangements.
Just then some hobbits, who had been sent out towards Hobbiton, came running in.
They're coming, they said. A score or more, but two have gone off west across country.
To Weymeat, that'll be, said Cotton, to fetch more of the gang. Well, it's 15 mile each way. We needn't trouble about them just yet.
Mary hurried off to give orders. Farmer Cotton cleared the street, sending everyone indoors, except the older hobbits who had weapons of some sort. They had not long to wait. Soon they could hear loud voices, and then the tramping of heavy feet. Presently a whole squad of the ruffians came down the road. They saw the barrier and laughed. They didn't imagine that there was anything in this little land that would stand up to 20 of their kind together. The hobbits opened the barrier and stood aside.
Thank you, the men jeered. Now run home to bed before you're whipped.
Then they marched along the street shouting,
Put those lights out. Get indoors and stay there, or we'll take 50 of you to the lockholes for a year. Get in. The boss is losing his temper.
No one paid any heed to their orders, but as the ruffians passed, they closed in quietly behind and followed them. When the men reached the fire, there was Farmer Cotton standing all alone, warming his hands.
Who are you, and what do you think you're doing? Said the ruffian leader.
Farmer Cotton looked at him slowly.
"I was just going to ask you that," he said. "This isn't your country, and you're not wanted."
"Well, you're wanted anyhow," said the leader. "We want you. Take him, lads. Lock holds for him, and give him something to keep him quiet."
The men took one step forward and stopped short. There rose a roar of voices all round them, and suddenly they were aware that Farmer Cotton was not all alone. They were surrounded. In the dark, on the edge of the firelight, stood a ring of hobbits that had crept up out of the shadows. There was nearly 200 of them, all holding some weapon. Merry stepped forward.
"We've met before," he said to the leader, "and I warned you not to come back here. I warn you again. You're standing in the light and you're covered by archers. If you lay a finger on this farmer, or on anyone else, you'll be shot at once. Lay down any weapons that you have." The leader looked round. He was trapped. But he was not scared. Not now, with the score of his fellows to back him. He knew too little of hobbits to understand his peril. Foolishly, he decided to fight. It would be easy to break out.
"Adam, lads," he cried. "Let 'em have it."
With a long knife in his left hand and a club in the other, he made a rush at the ring, trying to burst out back towards Hobbiton. He aimed a savage blow at Merry, who stood in his way. He fell dead with four arrows in him. That was enough for the others. They gave in. Their weapons were taken from them, and they were roped together and marched off to an empty hut that they had built themselves, and there they were tied hand and foot and locked up under guard. The dead leader was dragged off and bedded.
"Seems almost too easy after all, don't it?" said Cotton. "I said we could master them, but we needed a call. You came back in the nick of time, Mr. Merry."
"There's more to be done still," said Merry. "If you're right in your reckoning, we haven't dealt with a tithe of them yet. But it's dark now. I think the next stroke must wait until morning. Then we must call on the chief."
"Why not now?" said Sam. "It's not much more than 6 o'clock, and I want to see my gaffer. Do you know what's come of him, Mr. Cotton?"
"He's not too well, and he's not too bad, Sam," said the farmer. "They dug up Bagshot Row, and that was a sad blow to him. He's in one of them new houses that the chief's men used to build while they still did any work other than burning and thieving, not above a mile from the end of Bywater. But he comes round to me when he gets a chance, and I see he's better fed than some of the poor bodies. All against the rules, of course. I'd have had him with me, but that wasn't allowed."
"Thank ye indeed, Mr. Cotton, and I'll never forget it," said Sam. "But I want to see him. That boss and that Sharky, as they spoke of, they might do a mischief up there before the morning."
"All right, Sam," said Cotton. "Choose a lad or two, and go and fetch him to my house. You'll not have need to go near the old Hobbiton village over water. My jolly here will show you."
Sam went off. Merry arranged for lookouts round the village and guards at the barriers during the night. Then he and Frodo went off with Farmer Cotton. They sat with the family in the warm kitchen, and the Cottons asked a few polite questions about their travels, but hardly listened to the answers. They were far more concerned with events in the Shire.
"It all began with Pimple, as we call him," said Farmer Cotton. "And it began as soon as you'd gone off, Mr. Frodo. He'd funny ideas, had Pimple. Seems he wanted to own everything himself, and then order other folk about. It soon came out that he already did own a sight more than was good for him, and he was always grabbing more, though where he got the money was a mystery. Mills and malthouses and inns and farms and leaf plantations. He'd already bought Sandyman's mill before he came to Bag End, seemingly. Of course he started with a lot of property in the South Farthing, which he had from his dad. And it seems he'd been selling a lot of the best leaf and sending it away quietly for a year or two. But at the end of last year, he began sending away loads of stuff, not only leaf. Things began to get short, and winter coming on too. Folk got angry, but he had his answer. A lot of men, ruffians mostly, came with great wagons, some to carry off the goods south away, and others to stay. And more came. And before we knew where we were, they were planted here and there all over the shire, and were felling trees and digging and building themselves sheds and houses just as they liked. At first, goods and damage were paid for by people, but soon they began lording it around and taking what they wanted. Then there was a bit of trouble, but not enough. Old Will the Mayor set off for Baggin to protest, but he never got there. Ruffians laid hands on him, and took and locked him up in a hole in Mickledelving, and there he is now. And after that, it would be soon after New Year, there wasn't no more mayor, and Pipple called himself Chief Sheriff, or just Chief, and did as he liked. And if anyone got uppish, as they called it, they followed Will. So things went from bad to worse. There wasn't no smoke left, save for the men, and the chief didn't hold with beer, save for his men, and closed all the inns. And everything except rules got shorter and shorter, unless one could hide a bit of one's own when the ruffians went round gathering stuff up for fair distribution, which meant they got it and we didn't, except for the leavings, which you could have at the sheriff houses, if you could stomach them. All very bad. But since Sharkey came, it's been plain ruination.
"Who is this Sharkey?" said Mary. "I heard one of the ruffians speak of him."
"The biggest ruffian of the lot, seemingly," answered Cotton. "It was about last harvest, end of September, maybe, that we first heard of him. We'd never seen him, but he's up at Bag End, and he's the real chief now, I guess. All the ruffians do what he says, and what he says is mostly hack, burn, and ruin, and now it's come to killing. There's no longer even any bad sense in it. They cut down trees and let 'em lie. They burn houses and build no more. Take Sandyman's Mill now. Pipple knocked it down almost as soon as he came to Bag End. Then he brought in a lot of dirty-looking men to build a bigger one and fill it full of wheels and outlandish contraptions. Only that fool Ted was pleased by that, and he works there cleaning wheels for the men, where his dad was the miller and his own master. Pimple's idea was to grind more and faster, or so he said. He's got other mills like it, but you've got to have grist before you can grind, and there was no more for the new mill to do than for the old. But since Sharkey came, they don't grind no more corn at all. They're always a-hammering and a-letting out a smoke and a stench, and there isn't no peace, even at night in Hobbiton, and they pour out filth a-purpose. They've fouled all the lower water, and it's getting down into Brandywine. If they want to make the shire into a desert, they're going the right way about it. I don't believe that fool of a Pimple's behind all this. It's Sharkey, I say."
"That's right," put in young Tom. "Why, they even took Pimple's old ma, that Lobelia, and he was fond of her, if no one else was. Some of the Hobbiton folk, they saw it. She comes down the lane with her old umbrella. Some of the ruffians were going up with a big cart. 'Where be you a-going?' says she. 'To Bag End,' says they. 'What for?' says she. 'To put up some sheds for Sharkey,' says they. 'Who said you could?' says she. 'Sharkey,' says they. 'So get out of the road, old haggling. I'll give you Sharkey, you dirty thieving ruffians,' says she, and ups with her umbrella and goes for the leader, near twice her size. So they took her, dragged her off to the lock holes, at her age too. They've taken others we miss more, but there's no denying she showed more spirit than most." Into the middle of this talk came Sam, bursting in with his gaffer. Old Gamgee didn't look much older, but he was a little deafer.
"Good evening, Mr. Baggins," he said. "Glad indeed I am to see you safe back. But I've a bone to pick with you, in a manner of speaking, if I may make so bold. You didn't never ought to have a sold Bag End, as I always said. That's what started all the mischief. And while you've been traipsing in foreign parts, chasing black men up mountains from what my Sam says, though what for he don't make clear, they've been and dug a bagshot row and ruined my taters.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Gamgee, said Frodo, but now I've come back, I'll do my best to make amends.
Well, you can't say fairer than that, said the gaffer. Mr. Frodo Baggins is a real gentle hobbit, I always have said, whatever you may think of some others of the name, begging your pardon. And I hope my Sam's behaved hisself and given satisfaction.
Perfect satisfaction, Mr. Gamgee, said Frodo. Indeed, if you will believe it, he's now one of the most famous people in all the lands, and they're making songs about his deeds from here to the sea and beyond the great river. Sam blushed. But he looked gratefully at Frodo, for Rose's eyes were shining and she was smiling at him.
"It takes a lot of believing," said the gaffer, "though I can see he's been mixing in strange company. What's come of his waistcoat? I don't hold with wearing ironmongery, whether it wears well or no."
Farmer Cotton's household and all his guests were up early next morning. Nothing had been heard in the night, but more trouble would certainly come before the day was old.
"Seems as if none of the ruffians were left up at Bag End," said Cotton, "but the gang from Waymeet will be along any time now."
After breakfast, a messenger from the Tookland rode in. He was in high spirits.
"The thane has raised all our country," he said, "and the news is going like fire always. The ruffians that were watching our land have fled off south, those that escaped alive. The Thane has gone after them to hold off the big gang down that way, but he sent Mr. Peregrine back with all the other folk he can spare."
The next news was less good. Medi, who had been out all night, came riding in about 10 o'clock. "There's a big band about 4 miles away," he said. "They're coming along the road from Waymeet, but a good many stray ruffians have joined up with them. There must be close on 100 of them, and they're fire-raising as they come, curse them."
This lot won't stay to talk. They'll kill if they can," said Farmer Cotton. "If Tooks don't come sooner, we'd best get behind cover and shoot without arguing. There's got to be some fighting before this is settled, Mr. Frodo."
The Tooks did come sooner. Before long they marched in, 100 strong, from Tuckborough and the Green Hills with Pippin at their head. Merry now had enough sturdy hobbitry to deal with the ruffians. Scouts reported that they were keeping close together. They knew that the countryside had risen against them, and plainly meant to deal with the rebellion ruthlessly at its centre in Bywater. But however grim they might be, they seemed to have no leader among them who understood warfare. They came on without any precautions. Merry laid his plans quickly. The ruffians came tramping along the east road, and without halting, turned up the Bywater Road, which ran for some way, sloping up between high banks and low hedges on top. Round a bend, about a furlong from the main road, they met a stout barrier of old farm carts upturned. They halted them. At the same moment, they became aware that the hedges on both sides, just above their heads, were all lined with hobbits. Behind them, other hobbits now pushed out some more wagons that had been hidden in a field, and so blocked the way back. A voice spoke to them from above.
"Well, you have walked into a trap," said Merry. "Your fellows from Hobbiton did the same, and one is dead and the rest are prisoners. Lay down your weapons. Then go back 20 paces and sit down. Any who try to break out will be shot."
But the ruffians could not now be cowed so easily. A few of them obeyed, but were immediately set on by their fellows. A score or more broke back and charged the wagons. 6 were shot, but the remainder burst out, killing 2 hobbits, and then scattering across country in the direction of the woody end. 2 more fell as they ran. Merry blew a loud horn call, and there were answering calls from a distance.
"They won't get far," said Pippin. "All that country is alive with our hunters now."
Behind, the trapped men in the lane, still about 80, tried to climb the barrier and the banks, and the hobbits were obliged to shoot many of them or hew them with axes. But many of the strongest and most desperate got out on the west side and attacked their enemies fiercely, being now more bent on killing than escaping. Several hobbits fell, and the rest were wavering when Merry and Pippin, who were on the east side, came across and charged the ruffians. Merry himself slew the leader, a great squint-eyed brute like a huge orc. Then he drew his forces off, encircling the last remnant of the men in a wide ring of archers. At last all was over. Nearly 70 of the ruffians lay dead on the field, and a dozen were prisoners. 19 hobbits were killed, and some 30 were wounded. The dead ruffians were laden on wagons and hauled off to an old sandpit nearby and buried. In the battle pit, as it was afterwards called, the fallen hobbits were laid together in a grave on the hillside, where later a great stone was set up with a garden about it. So ended the Battle of Bywater, 1419, the last battle fought in the Shire, and the only battle since the Greenfields, 1147, away up in the North Farthing. In consequence, though it happily cost very few lives, it has a chapter to itself in the Red Book, and the names of all those who took part were made into a roll and learned by heart by Shire historians. The very considerable rise in the fame and fortune of the Cottons dates from this time, but at the top of the roll, in all accounts, stand the names of Captains Merry Ardoch and Peregrine. Frodo had been in the battle, but he had not drawn sword, and his chief part had been to prevent the hobbits in their wrath at their losses from slaying those of their enemies who threw down their weapons. When the fighting was over and the later labours were ordered, Merry, Pippin and Sam joined him, and they rode back with the Cottons. They ate a late midday meal, and then Frodo said with a sigh, "Well, I suppose it's time now that we dealt with the chief." "Yes, indeed. The sooner the better," said Merry. "And don't be too gentle. He's responsible for bringing in these ruffians and for all the evil they've done." Farmer Cotton collected an escort of some 24 sturdy hobbits.
"For it's only a guess that there is no ruffians left at Bag End," he said. "We don't know."
Then they set out on foot. Frodo, Sam, Merry and Pippin led the way. It was one of the saddest hours in their lives. The great chimney rose up before them, and as they drew near the old village across the water, through rows of new mean houses along each side of the road, they saw the new mill in all its frowning and dirty ugliness, a great brick building straddling the stream, which it fouled with a steaming and stinking overflow. All along the Bywater Road every tree had been felled. As they crossed the bridge and looked up the hill, they gasped. Even Sam's vision in the mirror had not prepared him for what they saw. The old grange on the west side had been knocked down, and its place taken by rows of tarred sheds. All the chestnuts were gone. The banks and hedgerows were broken. Great wagons were standing in disorder in a field, beaten bare of grass. Bagshot Row was a yawning sand and gravel quarry. Bag End, up beyond, could not be seen for a clutter of large huts.
"They've cut it down," cried Sam. "They've cut down the party tree."
He pointed to where the tree had stood, under which Bilbo had made his farewell speech. It was lying lopped and dead in the field. As if this was the last straw, Sam burst into tears.